Say, loudly enough to be heard on the other end of the line, I'm sorry, but you can't go out tonight, Dylan. And then I'd add something like, you promised you'd clean your room, or do your homework, or join us for dinner. At the time, I was simply happy that Dylan wanted distance. I had told both my sons they could always use me as an excuse in an emergency. I was thinking particularly of drinking and driving, but I meant any unsafe situation. So I was pleased not only that Dylan had taken me up on my long-standing offer, but that he'd found a way to separate from his friend without hurting Eric's feelings. After I saw the dynamic between Eric and Dylan on the basement tapes, I found myself revisiting this episode in a new light. If Dylan didn't want to go out with Zach or Nate or Robin or any of his other friends, he simply told them so. Nah, I can't this weekend. I need to write this paper. Only with Eric did he need me to bail him out. I never wondered about that or thought to ask Dylan, why can't you just say no? Asking for my help seemed like a sign of his good judgment. But afterward, I realized that it was a portent of something much more disturbing. It was a sign I had missed until it was too late. During one of our conversations, Frank Ockberg said, Dylan did not have the profile of a killer, but he had vulnerability to become enmeshed with one. FBI investigators found that Eric had tried to interest other boys in a plan of mass destruction, including Zach and Mark Manis. They didn't bite. Dylan did. Annotated note from interview with Dr. Marissa Randazzo, February 2015. Randazzo. There is often a fine line between people who are suicidal and homicidal. Most suicides are not homicidal, but many who are homicidal are there because of suicidality. I believe this is what happened to Dill. Criminal justice specialist Dr. Adam Langford, author of The Myth of Martyrdom, studies the suicidality of suicide bombers and mass shooters. He writes that rampage shooters, like suicide bombers, share three main characteristics: mental health issues that have produced a desire to die, a deep sense of victimization, and the desire to earn fame and glory through killing. In one study, he looked at almost 200 rampage shooters involved in events from 1966 to 2010. Almost half of them died by suicide as part of their attacks. Others may have intended to die, but were restrained or taken into custody before they had the chance. Truly suicidal or not, rampage shooters have less than a 1% chance of escaping the consequences of their actions. To plan an event with such a disastrously low chance of escape or survival implies what Langford calls life indifference. According to threat assessment experts, mass shooters almost always follow a discernible path to the shootings they commit. Recognizing the signposts on that path is the key to preventing these events. The pathway often begins with the desire to die. For a long time, murder-suicide was viewed as a subset of murder, not of suicide. Some murder-suicides do correspond to the murder model, where suicide is a plan B, turned to only when other escape options have failed. But a shifting understanding of suicide and a closer look at the data have revealed that many murder-suicides, if not the vast majority, have their genesis in suicidal thoughts. In other words, as Dr. Joyner writes, if it can be shown that suicide is fundamental in murder-suicide, then suicide prevention is also murder-suicide prevention. In the case of Columbine, at least, I believe that is true. For years, I searched for the missing integer, the piece of Dylan's character that allowed him to do what he did. From what I've learned, I now believe the third segment of Dr. Joyner's Venn diagram, the capability to die by suicide, provides part of the answer. In his writings, Dylan takes comfort from the idea of death, but he does not seem to have the capability for suicide by himself. As Dr. Joyner points out, people have to become desensitized to the violence and the fear of pain in order to be able to harm themselves. He posits that this is why suicide rates are higher in populations routinely exposed to, and therefore inured to, pain and horror such as doctors, soldiers, and people with anorexia. Our natural instinct for survival is hardwired, and most people have to work themselves up to ignoring it over time. Dylan couldn't, by himself. He talks about suicide, but he does not, by himself, come up with a plan to do it. His writing about it, as it is about most things, is abstract. That paralysis is reflected throughout the journals. He wants a job working with computers, but he can't get one or keep the one he gets. He talks over and over about the girl he has a crush on, but there is no evidence he made any advances toward her. He agonizes over the letter he writes to her, but doesn't deliver it. In fact, there's no evidence they ever spoke. The same thing appears to be true for suicide, and he turns to Eric for help. He wrote, "Soon, either I'll commit suicide, or I'll get with blank, and it will be NBK for us." Dylan appears to have needed Eric's homicidal plan in order to be able to do what he most wanted to do, die by suicide. Dr. Joyner suggested to me that planning with Eric for the rampage may have been part of the way Dylan rehearsed his own death. The preparations helped him to desensitize himself. For years after the attack, I resisted blaming Eric for Dylan's participation. I believed, as I still do at some level, that whatever hold Eric might have had over him, Dylan was still accountable for the choices he made. At one point, at least, he was separate enough and objective enough to tell me Eric was crazy, and ambivalent enough to try to get help, to distance himself from the relationship. Given what I have learned about psychopathy, I now feel differently. I find the violence and hatred seething off the page in Eric's journals almost unreadably dark, but his writing is clear, whereas Dylan's was not. As Dr. Langman puts it, Dylan's writing is jumbled, disorganized, and full of tangled syntax and misused words. Eric's thoughts are disturbing. Dylan's thought process is disturbed. The difference is in what Eric thinks and how Dylan thinks. We know Eric was overwhelmingly persuasive. His diversion counselor, dismissing him early from the program, said at the end of her final report, "Muy fácil hombre," which my Spanish-speaking friends translate as an affectionate characterization along the lines of "super easy guy." Eric's perceived halo may have extended to Dylan, whose own grades weren't good enough to justify his early dismissal from diversion. A number of the psychologists I've spoken to have told me how scarily charismatic and charming psychopaths can be, how quick they are to find the wedge, and how masterfully they work the lever. I'm not sure that Dylan, especially in an impaired state, was in a position to extricate himself from that relationship. Dr. Randazzo has interviewed a number of would-be school shooters, intercepted before they could execute their terrible plans. She describes both their ambivalence and their tunnel vision. When they reach that point of desperation, they're looking for a way out. They can't see any other options. They just don't care. Knowing this does not for a moment lessen Dylan's culpability, but it may get us closer to an explanation of how he came to be there. Dr. Duane Fuselier, a clinical psychologist and the supervisor in charge of the FBI team during the Columbine investigation, told me, "I believe Eric went to the school to kill people and didn't care if he died, while Dylan wanted to die and didn't care if others died as well." Chapter 13. Pathway to Suicide, Dylan's Junior Year. Journal entry, May 1999. 4-hour lawyer appointment was upsetting. The more we talked, the more we saw how this perfect kid was not so perfect. By the time we were done, we felt that our lives had not only been useless, but had been destructive. We wanted to believe that Dylan was perfect. We let ourselves accept that and really didn't see signs of his own anger and frustration. I don't know if I can ever live with myself. I have so much regret. In his junior year, Dylan got into trouble. Not once or twice, but a few times, in a series of escalating events. That makes this the hardest chapter in this book for me to write, because I know most people reading it will say, "Hey, Sue, this kid was falling apart, and you just stood by and did nothing. What the hell were you thinking?" The signs that Dylan was struggling were not overt or glaring, but we observed them and misinterpreted them. Now, the overwhelming majority of children, even if they are facing brain health challenges, are not going to commit a school shooting. If you live with a teenager, though, there's a reasonable chance he or she is struggling with a brain disorder. An estimated 1 in 5 children and adolescents has a diagnosable mental health condition. Only 20% of those kids are identified. That is why parents too often learn or think about brain health issues in teens only after those issues result in violence, crime, or self-harm. Despite its prevalence and the danger it poses, brain illness in teenagers too often goes unrecognized, even by caring teachers, well-meaning counselors and pediatricians, and the most vigilant parents. Left untreated, even the mildest brain health impairment can derail a young person's life and stop a child from reaching his or her full potential, a tragedy in itself. A disease like depression can also have much more serious consequences, as it sets many of the traps that snag children in adolescence. Drug and alcohol abuse, drunk driving, petty crime, eating disorders, cutting, abusive relationships, and high-risk sexual behaviors among them. In 1999, I did not know the difference between the sadness and lethargy I had always called depression, and clinical depression, which many sufferers describe as a feeling of nothingness. I had no idea that about 20% of teenagers experience a depressive episode, or that experiencing one episode puts them at a higher risk of another. A recent CDC report puts that number closer to 30%. I did not know that depression manifests itself differently in teenagers than it does in adults. Where adults may appear sad and low energy, teenagers, especially boys, tend to withdraw and show increased irritability, self-criticism, frustration, and anger. Unexplained pains, whininess, sleep disorders, and clinginess are common symptoms of depression among younger children. Neither did I know that the symptoms of depression in adolescence are often masked by the many other developmental and behavioral changes they're going through, which may be one of the reasons diagnosis often comes too late. Parents may not be alarmed by a teenager who sleeps late into the weekend, or a good eater who pushes away his plate. Ugh, gross. Although changes in sleep and appetite can be symptoms of depression, diagnosis is further complicated because many depressed children show none of these signs. Dylan's depression remained undiagnosed and untreated. In this, he was not alone. The vast majority of depressed teens do not get the help they need, even as their condition interferes with their relationships with friends and family and with their schoolwork, and dramatically raises the risk they'll get into trouble with the law or die by suicide. In Dylan's case, of course, it was both. Tom and I did know Dylan was going through a rough patch. That year, the whole family was plagued by health problems and money worries. Tom and I spent quite a bit of time worried about Byron, who had moved into his own apartment. The overall difficulty of the year contributed to our failure to see what was right in front of us. There was another reason Tom and I did not react with greater purpose when Dylan's life went off the rails in junior year, and that is because he seemed to get himself back on track. At the end of that year and throughout his senior year, after the damage and disappointment of the previous months, Dylan seemed intent to prove to us he was getting his life together. I mention this not to make an excuse, but because it is such a common refrain among parents who have lost children to suicide. "He was so much better," those shocked parents say, as Dylan seemed better to us. To borrow a cliché, We thought he'd been scared straight by the gravity of the trouble he'd gotten into the year before. Unfortunately, the finish line he was moving toward with such clarity was not, as we believed, an independent life in a dorm room at the University of Arizona while earning a degree in his beloved computer science. Instead, it was a plan that would end in his own death and those of so many others. Journal entry, July 1997. Things have been really happy this summer. Dylan is yucking it up and having a great time with friends. The summer between Dylan's sophomore and junior years was low-key. There was, however, one disturbing incident, and it involved Eric Harris. Dylan hadn't played soccer since kindergarten, but he decided to join the team Eric played for that summer, and they gave him a shot, although he had no experience and few skills. We were pleased to hear he was joining the team, as soccer wouldn't strain the arm he'd injured pitching. Plus, we admired his willingness to try a sport he hadn't played in years. Dylan wasn't a great athlete. He was strong, but lacked agility and the coordination to manage his long, gangly limbs. He did not play soccer particularly well, but he attended practice faithfully. When the team made the playoffs, Tom and I came out to watch. Dylan played poorly, and the team lost. Still sweaty, Eric and Dylan came over to where we were standing with the Harrises. Before we could congratulate them on a good effort, Eric began to scream. Spittle flying from his mouth, he lashed out at Dylan, ranting about his poor performance. Chattering parents and boys from both teams fell silent and stared. Eric's parents flanked him and guided him off the field as Tom, Dylan, and I drifted slowly in stunned humiliation toward our own car. I couldn't hear what the Harrises were saying to Eric, but they appeared to be trying to settle him down. Dylan walked between Tom and me, silent and impassive. I was shocked by the sudden inappropriateness of the display and by the extremity of Eric's rage. Dylan's utter lack of affect alarmed me, too. He had to be wounded, though he revealed nothing. My heart ached for him. I wanted to hug him, but he was 15 years old and surrounded by his team. I couldn't embarrass him further. As soon as we got inside the car, though, I said, "Man, what a jerk! I can't believe Eric!" As Tom started the car, Dylan stared out the window with a blank expression on his face. His calm in the face of Eric's freakout seemed unnatural, and I hoped he'd allow himself to acknowledge anger or humiliation as we drove away, but he did not. I pressed him, wishing he'd blow off steam. "Didn't it hurt your feelings to have him act like that? I'd be incredibly upset if a friend treated me that way." Dylan was still looking out the window, and his expression didn't change when he answered me, "Nah, that's just Eric." Tom, I could tell, was fuming. Dylan, on the other hand, appeared detached, as if he'd already shrugged it off. How fragile must Eric's ego be to be that upset about losing a dumb soccer game? I was more embarrassed for him than I was for Dylan. The tantrum had made Eric seem like a much younger child. Over the course of the drive home, I kicked into my mom rescue mode. As if I knew anything about it at all, I suggested various ways Dylan could fix his soccer game. I thought I was probably making his humiliation worse, but I couldn't stop myself. I told him that if I'd learned anything in my years of being chosen last for every team in high school, it was that the best players tended to go after the ball as if their lives depended on it. The people who won were usually the ones who wanted it most. Dylan said nothing, and I wound down. At the next game, the last of the season, he surprised us by playing better than he'd ever played before, charging to gain control of the ball. They lost, but Dylan's coach praised his improvement, and he seemed more at ease with himself. Foolishly, I thought my advice might have helped a little, and Tom and I were both pleased to see that Eric showed no more evidence of poor sportsmanship. Tom was furious with Eric for screaming. He never did entirely forgive him, but did not forbid the relationship. Dylan, we thought, could handle himself. In hindsight, of course, I wish we had been brutal in our separation of the two boys. Quote from the American Association of Suicidology. Losses and other events, whether anticipated or actual, can lead to feelings of shame, humiliation, or despair, and may serve as triggering events for suicidal behavior. Triggering events include losses, such as the breakup of a relationship or a death, academic failures, trouble with authorities, such as school suspensions or legal difficulties, bullying, or health problems. This is especially true for youth already vulnerable because of low self-esteem or a mental disorder, such as depression. Help is available and should be arranged. As soon as Dylan's junior year started, the whole family was bombarded by problems. The first few months of Byron's experiment in independence were hard to watch. I reassured myself by thinking about Irma Bombeck's statement about her own boys. They lived like hamsters. Still, I worried. At least I knew he was getting 2 or 3 decent meals a week. He came to us most Sunday evenings for dinner and always left with a bag of hearty leftovers. Byron's diet and housekeeping abilities were the least of our worries about him. That fall, he weathered one crisis after another. First, a car sideswiped his while he was waiting at an intersection. His injuries were minor. Nevertheless, it was scary, and his car was totaled. He continued to cycle through a succession of menial jobs. He'd often quit them for trivial reasons, like not wanting to get up early or to wear the uniform. When he could afford to pay his bills, he'd sometimes forget. I had a fundamental belief in Byron's goodness, as I did in Dylan's. "He'll get it together," I often reassured Tom. But when every phone call brought news of a fresh setback, even I couldn't help wondering if Byron was ever going to settle down. I was going through changes of my own. In September, after an extended period of political upheaval at the college where I worked, I started a new job coordinating a small grant to help people with disabilities in the community college system acquire computer skills. I only had to go to the office 4 days a week, but I took a fairly significant pay cut. The grant was also time-limited, which added a degree of uncertainty. My commute was almost an hour longer than it had been, and I found it a little unsettling to know it would take me so long to get to my kids if they needed me. The biggest stressor in our lives, though, was the rapid and alarming decline in Tom's health. For years, he'd complained of joint pain, stiff knees, a sore neck, sharp shooting pains he described as ice picks in his toes. He experienced periods of unexplained weakness and a series of crippling migraines, like little strokes, which left him temporarily unable to see or to speak. A diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, right about the time Dylan entered high school, explained the chronic pain. RA is degenerative, so Tom was afraid his health would continue to worsen, leaving him disabled and unable to work. One morning at breakfast, while he was lifting a carton of orange juice, a tendon snapped in his arm. The two of us stared dumbly at his thumb, which was no longer a working digit, but dangling loosely from his hand. Tom is a bull for whom no project is too daunting, a man who'd think nothing of working an 18-hour day swinging a sledgehammer, who'd lay concrete until his knees bled, and he'd been vanquished by a half-gallon of Tropicana. He was falling apart. The constant pain, combined with his uncertainty, meant he couldn't work the long days expected of a geophysicist. This added to our financial anxiety, especially with Dylan's college tuition looming ahead of us. He cut back on projects around the house, although our fixer-upper still needed a lot of fixing up, and he couldn't go for his beloved evening runs, which had been his primary means of staying in shape and a way for him to relieve stress. We all could have used a better stress relief valve. Between our money worries, Tom's increasingly serious illness, my new job, and Byron's instability, I felt like a captain keeping a ship on course through a storm, while reassuring my panicking crew. Most nights, I would fall into bed so exhausted I could barely manage to brush my teeth, and often lay awake worrying that our family wouldn't be okay at all. Disruptions like these, especially money worries and a parent undergoing a health crisis, are risk factors for depression and suicide in teens, and a combination of them significantly increases risk. We did notice Dylan was crankier with us than usual. We had a gentle household overall. We weren't door slammers or yellers, and our boys weren't allowed to talk back or to use bad language in front of us or any other adult. Even during the worst of our struggles with Byron, I was proud that we were always able to talk civilly with each other. Being a teenager, Dylan managed anyway to convey his sullenness and irritation. If I asked him to slow down when he was driving, he'd reward me with a long, slow sigh, and he'd drive like a granny for a couple of miles to make sure I got the point. "Would you please change your sheets before you go out?" I'd ask, and he'd roll his eyes almost imperceptibly as he was turning away to go do it. I didn't enjoy this behavior, but took it in stride. Lots of other moms were dealing with much worse in the disrespect department. With Dylan, there were still flashes of sweetness to keep us from worrying too much. When I worried about his mood swings or his irritability, he'd cheerfully run an errand with me, or join Tom and me for dinner and keep us laughing until we forgot our concerns. He wasn't the kind of kid you could stay worried about for long. Until he was. Because that year, as if everything going on with Tom and Byron and our finances weren't enough, the one family member who had always seemed to get through life without much trouble began to have problems of his own. Dylan turned 16 in September. When Tom and I suggested a party, he demurred, "Guys, I don't want to make a big deal out of this." But his 16th birthday is a milestone, and Tom and I wanted to mark it for Dylan. Our family tradition was to go to a restaurant of the celebrant's choice. That year, Dylan chose a barbecue restaurant with a 1940s classic movie theme. Byron couldn't get anyone to cover him at work. While we hated for him to miss his brother's birthday celebration, we were pleased to see evidence of his work ethic and supported his decision not to attend. Plus, Tom and I had a surprise planned. Although Dylan's friend Zach also had to work that night, we'd arranged for Eric and Nate to meet us at the restaurant. Dylan was genuinely surprised to see his friends. So surprised, it took him half the evening to loosen up and start enjoying himself. I was sympathetic. He was attuned to the slightest of social discomforts, though Nate and Eric found us much less embarrassing than he did. Dylan knew of our intolerance for rudeness and picky eaters as well, and was probably worried about how his friends would behave. Over the course of the night, though, he relaxed, and with good humor, he thanked us for overriding his protests and surprising him. But the roller coaster ride was about to begin. Later that month, he woke up in the middle of the night with terrible stomach pains. We were concerned enough to take him to the emergency room, where they ruled out appendicitis and everything else. Puzzled, the doctors released him, and he appeared to recover completely. I would later learn that unexplained somatic symptoms, particularly abdominal pain, may be a marker for depression. Then 2 days later, at the beginning of October 1997, Tom received a call from the school. Dylan had been suspended. The news was a shock. It was the first time either of our boys had been disciplined at school. Dylan's interest in server maintenance and network administration had led one of the teachers to ask if he and his friend Zach would help maintain the Columbine High School computer system. Digging around in the system, the boys discovered a list of locker combinations. Dylan opened and closed one or two locker doors to see if the list was current, then transferred the data to a disk and shared it with Eric. Zach took it a little further and left a note in the locker of his girlfriend's ex-boyfriend. The boys were caught, and an administrator at the school informed us that Dylan was to be suspended for 5 days. Tom and I thought the punishment was unnecessarily harsh. Dylan deserved a disciplinary consequence for his involvement. He had no right to dig into school records. But he'd only opened the lockers to see if he could, and closed them without touching anything. Tom, in particular, felt the punishment failed to show the boys why the offense was wrong and alienated them from their school when it would be better for them to feel connected to it. We both hoped the school would consider a warning or probationary period instead of banishment and arranged to meet with the dean. It was not a good meeting. There was nothing in the rule book to cover what the boys had done. In the absence of written policy, the administration had decided to treat the boys as if they had brought a weapon to school. I was shocked. What they had done seemed closer to sneaking into the girls' bathroom or an act of academic dishonesty like plagiarism or cheating. I wasn't minimizing the offense, nor would I have thought it was okay to sneak into the girls' bathroom. But the boys hadn't brought a weapon to school or done anything like it. We asked if the administration might consider other consequences. The boys could donate extra time to maintain equipment or clean out a storage room. The dean told us that the district superintendent was aware of the incident and wanted it to be handled with a high level of severity. We could speak with the computer teacher if we had additional questions. An administrator myself, I recognized the dean's need to get the papers signed so she could move on to the next problem. While we waited for the computer teacher, I got a moment alone with Dylan. I wanted him to understand the consequences of what he had done. He was fond of the teacher, and I told Dylan he could have gotten him fired or caused the elimination of the program altogether. There was no defiance or cynicism on Dylan's face, just sadness. I was satisfied to see he understood. The teacher, when he joined us, seemed shaken but kind and primarily concerned about Dylan. There were apologies all around. What came next, however, was more painful for Dylan than the suspension. The teacher told Dylan he could no longer help with the school's computers. As we drove away from the school, Dylan seemed numb. I asked him if he thought he'd be okay. He told me he would. He was taking accelerated chemistry, trigonometry, world history, fourth-year French, computers, and composition, a fairly heavy workload of difficult classes, and I asked how he would keep up during his suspension. He said he could get the assignments from his friends. When Dylan asked what I was thinking, I told him the truth. I don't understand the decision, and I don't agree with it, but I'm going to support it. This will be resolved quickly if we comply with the ruling, and I don't want to make a bad situation worse by alienating you from the people running the school. He nodded to show he understood. Tom was home with Dylan most of the time during the suspension. During one conversation, Dylan complained that the school's administration favored athletes, making excuses for them while coming down hard on others for lesser offenses. In Dylan's mind, school was a place where things were not fair. Yet he seemed to take the suspension in stride, and after the 5 days were up, all three of us smoothed our ruffled feathers and moved on. In October, Dylan got his driver's license. I was nervous about him driving around without an adult in the car, but he was relieved not to have to depend on us or on his friends for rides. Tom's hobby was finding beat-up old cars at bargain prices. As soon as he felt Dylan could handle a car responsibly, he bought a black BMW for $400. It had a broken window and some interior damage, not to mention it was light years away from being able to pass Colorado's emissions tests. But the two of them weren't daunted by the amount of work it needed, and they both got a kick out of the fact that the car was 16 years old, exactly Dylan's age. Dylan agreed to help pay for gas and insurance. After Dylan got his license, I told my sister it was as if he'd grown wings. Most of his friends were still in the suburb we'd left behind when we'd moved out to the foothills. From a safety standpoint, we'd rather he stay overnight with them than drive home late on the canyon road. But I didn't like feeling so separate. Tom reminded me I had to let him grow up. He and Nate and Eric and Zach went bowling, played pool, or went to the movies. Occasionally there were supervised parties. Raising teenagers was not new to us, and Dylan faced the usual barrage of questions when leaving the house. Where are you going? Who's going to be there? Who's driving? Will there be drinking? Will the parents be home? Leave us a phone number. We checked often, and Dylan was always exactly where he said he'd be. The only time he ever came home late for curfew, he'd gone to the rescue of a friend stranded after a fender bender. Tom and I did feel Dylan was withdrawing from us that year. He'd quit Blackjack Pizza so he could look for a job working with computers, but he hadn't found one, and he wasn't doing sound for any school productions that fall. It was nice to have him home at night, though I worried he had too much time on his hands and thought he spent too much time on his computer. Withdrawal, of course, can be a sign of depression in adults and teens, but Tom and I didn't identify Dylan's desire for privacy as a red flag. When he was in his room, he was either talking to friends on the phone or interacting with them on the computer. He wasn't withdrawing from others. If anything, his social life had taken off. The unsettled feeling with which we'd begun the fall continued as the days grew cooler. One of my favorite teachers at the Art Students League died suddenly of a heart attack. My brother's wife was hospitalized, and my sister, who had struggled for years with health problems, was unwell again. Tom's health continued to deteriorate. In November, he had surgery to fix the broken tendon in his arm, and he scheduled a shoulder surgery for January. He still couldn't work much, and our financial concerns intensified. A friend consoled me with the Winston Churchill chestnut, "If you're going through hell, keep going." But the bad news kept coming. We got a call from Byron in the emergency room. He needed stitches in three places after standing up to a racist ex-skinhead. That night, I finally allowed myself to acknowledge my despair over Byron's situation. Of course, I was proud of him for standing up for his beliefs, but his decisions kept getting him into trouble, and nothing we did, therapy, support, tough love, seemed to help. Thanksgiving was a rare bright spot in that dark season. Eight of my extended family members came to stay, a hectic change from the quiet life we usually led. My brother and my sister and I have always been close. We all talk too fast and laugh loudly. Getting a word in is like merging onto the Autobahn. Dylan found the chaos a little overwhelming, but I loved having my family around. My dad owned neighborhood movie theaters. My first job was selling popcorn at a concession stand, and we're passionate about old movies. We all love books and music, too. Not surprisingly, we like to play charades. Dylan usually preferred to play poker with the adults, but that year he gave in to the begging and joined us for a round or two of charades. I was so proud of how funny and clever he was, and delighted that his innate shyness hadn't prevented him from joining us. There was no way to know that within a few short months, everything would fall apart, and Dylan would once again rise to the top of our family's worries. In early January of 1998, Dylan told Tom about his frustration with a couple of kids at school who were really asking for it. The kids were freshmen, and Tom resisted the temptation to laugh. Dylan was 6'4" tall and a junior. Dylan told us he wanted to get some guys together to confront the boys. Tom and I told him not to give them the satisfaction of a response. I was worried someone would be hurt, and Tom was worried Dylan would embarrass himself by engaging with freshmen. Dylan could not let it go. Without our knowledge, he and Eric rounded up some friends. They confronted the kids and told them to meet them at a spot away from the school, but the younger boys never appeared. Tom and I found out about the planned rumble after the fact. Dylan believed he had handled the situation effectively, but we were upset and told him so. At least, I thought, no one had been hurt. Later that month, I got a call from Judy Brown, the mother of Dylan's friend Brooks. Brooks and Eric had gotten into a fight at school, and Eric had thrown a snowball at Brooks's car, damaging the windshield. Judy was furious and launched into a tirade against Eric, which perplexed me. It seemed to me that the boys shared responsibility for the incident, and I didn't understand her impulse to get involved when they'd resolved it themselves. The ferocity of her hatred for Eric seemed like an overreaction to me. Not long after the call from Judy, Tom got another call from the school. 4 months after his suspension for hacking the locker combinations, Dylan had deliberately scratched the face of someone's locker with a key. He was given an in-school suspension for a day and owed the school $70 to pay for a new door. Tom went over to write the check. He asked the dean about the freshman, certain that Dylan would not have lashed out without being provoked. The dean acknowledged they had a particularly rowdy group of freshmen acting as if they owned the place, but assured Tom that the administration was dealing with it. We talked with Dylan that night. Tom was irritated with him for destroying property and irritated with the school for charging so much money to repaint a locker door. Dylan gave Tom the cash he had on hand and promised to work off the rest of the debt by doing extra chores. I told Dylan he couldn't allow the obnoxious behavior of others to upset him. I don't know whose locker Dylan scratched, or if it was simply the one in front of him when the destructive urge hit. I have read in the years since that the scratch read fags, a slur I have also read was frequently leveled against Dylan and Eric in the hallways at Columbine, but we did not hear that from the school. It is, of course, not ridiculous that a younger boy could bully an older one. I simply never imagined anyone would bully Dylan. My idea of the type of kid targeted by bullies was as unrealistic a stereotype as my idea of the kind of person who dies by suicide. The way he dressed and wore his hair was intended to set him apart from the preppy, affluent, suburban mainstream, but it was not outrageous. We also believed Dylan's height would be intimidating because he told us it was. Once during sophomore year, Dylan said something to Tom about hating the jocks. Tom asked him if they were giving him a hard time, and Dylan answered with confidence, "They don't bother me. I'm 6'4", but they sure give Eric hell." Since the tragedy, much has been written about the school culture at Columbine High School and Dylan's place in it. Regina Herter, director of juvenile diversion for the Denver District Attorney's Office, compiled a report in 2000, and Ralph W. Larkin independently confirmed many of her findings in his exhaustively researched 2007 book, Comprehending Columbine. Both researchers found Columbine High School was academically excellent and deeply conservative, that much we knew, but they also describe a school with a pervasive culture of bullying, in particular, a group of athletes who harassed, humiliated, and physically assaulted kids at the bottom of the social ladder. Larkin also points to proselytizing and intimidation by evangelical Christian students, a self-appointed moral elite who perceived the kids who dressed differently as evil and targeted them. This research lines up with many anecdotal stories we heard after the tragedy from kids who suffered physical and psychological abuse at the hands of their classmates at the school. One story in particular stands out. When Tom went to the sheriff's department in the fall of 1999 to retrieve Dylan's car from the impound lot, a county employee offered his condolences and told him how his own son's hair had been set on fire by some other students while he was attending Columbine High School. The boy, who sustained fairly serious burns to his scalp, refused to allow his father to go to the administration because he was afraid it would make the situation worse. Shaking with anger as he spoke, though the incident was no longer recent, the outraged dad told Tom he had wanted to take the school apart brick by brick. About 5 years after the massacre, I spoke with a Columbine High School counselor. He told me that after an earlier publicized bullying incident, the high school had implemented closer supervision of the student body, including teachers in the hallways between classes and in the cafeteria at lunch. But we agreed it's impossible to control what 2,000 students are doing on a campus, or to know what those kids are doing to one another in the Dairy Queen parking lot. Despite the administration's claim that steps were taken to stem conflict among students, their efforts fell short. For many people, Columbine High School was a hostile and frightening place, even if you were one of the most popular kids, and Dylan and his friends were not. One of our neighbors told us her grown son's reaction to the tragedy, a refrain we heard many times. "I'm just surprised it didn't happen sooner." Both Herter and Larkin claim teachers turned a blind eye to harassment and even violence in the hallways, either because they did not take it seriously, kids will be kids, or because they sided with the popular athletes doing the bullying. They cite instances where school administrators declined to take action, even after being informed of specific incidents. This isn't as surprising as it would be now. Bullying wasn't on the cultural radar in 1999. There weren't federal laws against it, or mandated school guidelines, or New York Times best-selling books about queen bees and sticks and stones. Peer cruelty certainly wasn't seen as the serious public health issue we now understand it to be. Tom believes, as Larkin does, that the culture at Columbine was toxic, and a desire for revenge motivated the attack the boys launched on the school. Many experts disagree. Despite Larkin's claim that the propane bombs Dylan and Eric placed in the cafeteria were put under tables where the jocks typically sat, they did not target popular kids or athletes during the attack, or anyone at all. Of the 48 shooters profiled in Dr. Langman's book, School Shooters, Understanding High School, College, and Adult Perpetrators, only one of them specifically targeted a bully. Furthermore, there is almost no mention of bullying in Dylan's journal. If anything, he appears to have envied the jocks for their social comfort and ease with girls. I personally fall somewhere in the middle. Bullying, however severe, is not an excuse for physical retaliation or violence, much less mass murder. But I do believe Dylan was bullied, and that along with many other factors, and perhaps in combination with them, bullying probably did play some role in what he did. Given Dylan's temperament and core personality traits, it's easy to understand why being bullied would have been especially hurtful to him. He hated to be wrong and didn't like to lose. He was extremely self-conscious and critical of himself. Relentless self-criticism is, incidentally, another sign of depression. He liked to feel self-reliant and wanted to be perceived as someone who was in control. This sense of himself would have been badly eroded with each incident. Apparently, they were common. One day, Dylan came home, his shirt spotted with ketchup. He refused to tell me what had happened, only that he'd had the worst day of his life. I pressed, but Dylan downplayed it, and I let him. Kids have disagreements, I thought. Whatever it is, it'll blow over, and if it doesn't, I'll know. There has been reporting that the incident was more serious than I could ever have imagined. A circle of boys taunting Dylan and Eric, shoving them, spraying them with ketchup, and suggesting they were gay. That incident alone may not explain the deadly kinship forged between the boys, but it is the kind of shared humiliation in which a bond is formed. Tom and I were aware of another incident. Junior year, Dylan had a parking space in a remote lot next to the school grounds. A few weeks after he confronted the freshman, he told his father his car wasn't running well. Tom found the hood flattened as if someone had stood on it, leaving an indentation deep enough to damage the fuse box. Dylan said he hadn't noticed the dent. Tom asked him outright if the freshman had intentionally damaged his car. Dylan said he didn't know when or how it had happened, although he was certain it had happened in the school parking lot. The car was old, and we'd never expected it to survive high school without a few dings, but our failure to find out what happened to it is one thing I regret. Tom and I did not perceive Dylan as being unpopular. He simply had too many friends for us to see him that way. Unfortunately, we did not have the slightest idea what his daily life was really like at school. Larkin cites a video Dylan made. He and a few other boys are walking down a hallway, filming nothing in particular. Four students approach from the opposite direction. One of them, wearing a Columbine football sweatshirt, drives an elbow into Dylan's side as he passes, causing him to cry out and the video camera to swing wildly. The athletes laugh, and Dylan's friends mutter something inaudible. Larkin correctly sums up what's so chilling, which is that Dylan and his friends continue down the hallway after the hit as if nothing out of the ordinary has happened. Apparently, such behavior was common enough to be accepted as normative, Larkin writes. This observation was supported by a number of interviews he did with students. It mirrors our own conversations, too. One of Dylan's friends told me he'd never seen any examples of students mistreating other students, and then, in the very next breath, told me about kids hurling a soda can full of tobacco spit in his direction at a school sporting event. Another of Dylan's friends told us a car full of kids threw glass bottles and other trash at their group as they drove by. Larkin reports that throwing trash from moving cars at lower caste students was common. A resigned Dylan tried to comfort a horrified newcomer to the group. "You get used to it. It happens all the time." It hurts that it was so easy for Dylan to hide what his life was like at school. I still have dreams in which I discover his hidden pain. In one, I am undressing him, still a toddler, for a bath. I pull his shirt off and see a bloody network of concealed cuts across his torso. Even writing about it now makes me cry. Dylan's struggles may have been hidden from us, but they were not uncommon ones. A 2011 study by the Centers for Disease Control found that 20% of high school students nationwide reported they had been bullied on school property in the 30 days before the survey. An even higher percentage reported they'd been bullied on social media. Anti-bullying advocates suggest the number may be closer to 30%. A tremendous amount of research has been done on the effects of peer harassment, and there is unquestionably a correlation between bullying and brain health disorders that stretches all the way into adulthood. A Duke University study found that compared with kids who weren't bullied, those who were had 4 times the prevalence of agoraphobia, generalized anxiety, and panic disorder as adults. The bullies themselves had 4 times the risk of developing antisocial personality disorder. There is also a strong association between bullying and depression and suicide. Both being a victim and bullying others is related to high risks of depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide attempts. Researchers at Yale found that victims of bullying were 2 to 9 times more likely to report suicidal thoughts than other children. The connection between bullying and violence toward others is more complicated, although again, there's a correlation. Bullied kids often become bullies themselves, which appears to be what happened with Dylan and Eric. Larkin cites a student who claims they terrorized her brother, a student with special needs, so badly he was afraid to come to school. Researchers call students who both bully and suffer bullying bully victims, and find that these bully victims are at the greatest psychological risk. Their numbers compared to those never involved in bullying tell the story. 14 times the risk of panic disorder, 5 times the risk of depressive disorders, and 10 times the risk of suicidal thoughts and behavior. The humiliation and degradation Dylan experienced at the hands of his schoolmates likely did contribute to his psychological state. At some point, his anger, which had for years been directed toward himself, began to turn outward, and the idea of personal destruction he found so comforting began to include others. Repeated incidents of disrespect at school, an environment that should have been safe, may very well have constituted the pivot point. Of course, even if Dylan did endure humiliation at the hands of his classmates, it cannot absolve him in any way of responsibility for what he did. At the same time, I have deep regrets I wasn't more in tune with Dylan's feelings about the place he spent his days. I wish I had spent much more time and energy on determining the climate and culture of the school, and how appropriate it was for Dylan, than on assessing it academically. Once in a while, I allow myself to fantasize about the 1,000 ways the story could have ended differently, and all of those fantasies begin with a different school. My biggest regret, though, is that I did not do whatever it would have taken to know what Dylan's internal life was really like. At a suicide prevention conference I attended, a father described how he'd failed to recognize signs of depression in his 12-year-old daughter. He'd noticed she'd been whinier and clingier than usual, sure, and complaining of invisible ailments, even after her pediatrician had found nothing wrong. My stomach hurts. My head hurts. She'd been more reluctant than usual to go to bed, too. Just to the end of this chapter. 5 more minutes, I swear. But he had no inkling these were all potential signs of depression in a child of that age. I hadn't either. Years later, I mentioned this to a friend with an 11-year-old daughter. She was sufficiently alarmed to conduct an informal poll of the experienced parents she knew. Would they have recognized clinginess, hypochondria, and sleep disturbances as possible symptoms of depression in their own kids? Not one of them would have. Would you? More disturbingly, the father I met at that conference told me his daughter's pediatrician had also not recognized these signs, never mind that she was at an elevated risk to die by suicide. In approximately 80% of completed suicides, the individual has seen a physician within the year before their death, and almost half have seen a doctor within the prior month. Dylan went to our family doctor with a sore throat weeks before he died. It is essential for physicians to routinely screen for symptoms of depression and suicidal tendencies in their patients. Teachers, school counselors, coaches, these people can be powerful bystanders. Gatekeeper programs, like ASSIST, the Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training Program by LivingWorks, teach participants to identify people struggling with persistent thoughts of suicide. The interventions they make can save lives. Dylan's high school grades had never been particularly great, despite his intelligence, but they slipped far enough in the last few weeks of his senior year for two teachers to express concern. His hair was clean but long and untrimmed, and it stuck out from the backwards baseball cap he always wore, and his facial hair was patchy and grizzled. Everyone in his life, including Tom and me, attached a value judgment to what we observed, instead of wondering if there might be something wrong. This is one of the paradoxes we must confront. Of course, it would be easier to help depressed teens if they were nicer to be around or more communicative about their thoughts. If only they looked like the kids in the pamphlets do, clean-cut and attractive, staring out a rainy window with a wistful expression, chin propped on a fist. More commonly, though, a disturbed teenager will be unpleasant, aggressive, belligerent, obnoxious, irritable, hostile, lazy, whiny, untrustworthy, sometimes with poor personal hygiene. But the fact that they're so difficult, so dedicated to pushing us away, does not mean they do not need help. In fact, these traits may be signals that they do. The next incident during Dylan's junior year was the most catastrophic of all. On January 30th, a few days after Dylan scratched the locker at school, he and Eric were arrested for breaking into a parked van and stealing electronic equipment. Dylan had agreed to go with Zach to an activity at his church that night, and the two of them planned to come back to our house for a sleepover afterward. Tom and I were listening to music together in the living room when the phone rang around 8:30 p.m. It was Zach's dad, audibly upset. Zach had quarreled with his girlfriend and left the event with her. He'd gotten hurt, possibly after stepping out of a moving car, and wasn't making much sense. It was all very confusing, but Zach's parents wanted us to know the plan had changed. Dylan wasn't with Zach. He'd left the church with Eric. I thanked Zach's dad for the update and immediately called the Harrises, who were as concerned as we were not to know where the boys were. Both sets of parents promised to get in touch immediately if we heard from the kids. Within minutes, our phone rang again. It was the county sheriff. Dylan and Eric had been arrested for criminal trespass. Tom and I drove to the local sheriff's auxiliary office. The Harrises were already there. The offenses included first-degree criminal trespass and theft, both of which were felonies, and criminal mischief, a misdemeanor. My mouth hung open when I heard how serious the charges were. I could not believe that our Dylan, who had never done anything really wrong in his life, could do something so terrible. This was the kind of trouble that might seriously impact his future. Neither of us had ever been arrested, so we called one of our neighbors, a lawyer, for advice.